Welcome to Start Writing. I'm Joe Bendosky. As you probably noticed, we didn't release a new episode on Friday like we are supposed to. Once again, I had trouble either scheduling or getting the authors to agree to a specific date. As this has kind of become a trend, I think we might go back to the two interviews a month. So I will try and schedule one, and Jay will try and schedule one, and then we'll release two craft episodes in a month. While there's a lot more research into those to get them ready, it's a lot easier scheduling-wise just because in the last month and a half, I've just had a really hard time. I guess maybe there's a lot of conferences going on, but as I've contacted a variety of authors, just, you know, they have not just set a date with me. So because I'm trying to get this out really quickly, I haven't been able to schedule this with Jay. So this will be a craft episode just with me. And in the future, if we don't have an episode on Friday because the author canceled or whatever, then I will research over the weekend and prepare a craft episode and try to get that out by at least Tuesday. So you still will get an episode. It'll be a few days late and it'll be craft instead of interview. And so today, what we're going to talk about is setting. In the last couple weeks in my critique group and on Scribophile, I've encountered three different works that did what is called scene jumping. And that is where they will move through several scenes very quickly. And a lot of times these end up being what are called cardboard settings. And that is where the setting is just not very deep and not very well established. The term comes actually from plays and film where the setting is just this really cheap cardboard laid in the back that's been painted over. And, you know, it's like I said, it's just not a very strong setting to pull you into the moment and the story. So one of the things that I want to talk about is the importance of setting and how to leverage that setting to improve conflict and strengthen the mood and different things like that. Now, there's a lot of costs and benefits to building the setting. The first is that creating setting slows pace. As far as plot points go, a setting doesn't do any of that. And so it will slow the initial pace of a scene because you're going to be taking a paragraph or two to lay down that groundwork. However, on the flip side, jumping scenes very quickly means that you're laying down a lot of little bits of setting that aren't very strong, and you have to use a lot of transitions. And so that's where you're moving from one setting to another. Oftentimes what happens is the work is slowed down in the same way, whether you're moving through a lot of scenes or just sitting in one. And the difference is that moving through so many, they're not very well established. And so the reader never has a strong sense of where they are. There's a lot of tools that can be used to leverage that scene and that setting to strengthen what's going on. And the first one I want to talk about, and I think we've mentioned this very briefly in some of our other discussions, as I think when we talked about climax and a setting for climax, there'll be a little bit of overlap. So one is mood and priming. So the use of metaphors and careful wording choices can change the way a reader sees a scene, particularly how they read the emotion of the scene. So here's an interesting thing. With my book, I'm actually going to be giving it a new cover in the next week or two. And the reason is that as I've talked to people and as I've read some of the reviews and gotten feedback, a lot of people feel that the cover is very post-apocalyptic. And that is changing the way they interpret the book. One, I'm getting people who were buying and reading the book who were looking for post-apocalyptic, only to be surprised that it's an espionage thriller set in the 1980s. But there's another side to that as well, and that is that my book has a lot of history and a lot of science in it, and a lot of it is stuff that people are not familiar with. And post-apocalyptic is a subgenre of sci-fi. And so when they see the cover and they think post-apocalyptic, as they encounter the scientific ideas that I discuss within the book, they are trying to understand them as elements of science fiction as opposed to actual psychology and sociology and studies that have really been done. It's twisting the way they try to understand the story that's told to them. A great example I had was a psychology teacher. And on the board, he had a bunch of four-letter words that just, and the only thing you could actually see was the first letter of the word, and then it was just a bunch of dashes as what it would be. There was like 10 on each side of the board. And then at the very top of the board were two words, family and war. And he told us, just ignore those, that's for something later. And he had a bunch of people leave the room, and he would bring them in one by one. And then he would cover half of the board and half of the words, and either he would cover the word family or war when he did that, because he covered it all in just one big slate. And so people could see the word family and then a bunch of these dashed words below. And even though they were told it had nothing to do with it and they should just ignore it, when they encountered the word that started with H, they usually would say hope. And when they encountered the four-letter word that started with L, they would usually say love. And then he would bring somebody else in and they would see war at the top, told to ignore it. And then on the H word, they would say hate. And on the L word, they would usually say lust. And that is what is called priming. Even if you're told it's not related, it still puts an idea in your head that changes the way you interpret all the other information coming in. And that is what I've been seeing and hearing from people with the cover of my book. Is the cover is based on the big hoax that leads to the evacuation of a city that took place in the 1988s in Portugal. And I guess technically the event it's based on took place in 1948, but I've explained to people, I've kind of shifted some of the events in history, so I've taken some of the more dramatic ones and swapped them out for ones that did occur in the 80s, but were not quite as dramatic. And so the cover is just, you know, there was this huge media hoax, and it led to this huge panic and evacuation in the city, and that's what the cover is, but it looks very post-apocalyptic. And so people who want a post-apocalyptic book buy it, and then they try to understand the ideas and the events of the book as though it is post-apocalyptic. And that is leading to one confusion on their part as to what exactly the ideas mean. And two, they enjoy the book less because it's not what they like to read, it's not what they want, and they're trying to understand it in a way that is not intended to be understood. That's that element of priming. In the choice of my book cover, I have primed my readers for a different experience than they're actually going to be getting. So I'm going to be redoing that, but I wanted to bring it up here to point out how that priming takes place. And so as you write metaphors, or as you take your word choices in the setting, you can manipulate the emotion context that the reader will read the scene that is coming. There's a very famous line from a song that goes, "Where the viaduct looms like a bird of doom." And there's just some very powerful metaphors in setting the mood that the artist wanted for his lyrics there. And you can do the same kind of thing in setting a scene. If you know the mood you want the scene to have, whether it is a romance or an action scene, you know, whatever you're writing, you can look at those metaphors. Or even a friend of mine actually recommended, he said, know the mood, he says, and then write out some independent metaphors that strengthen that mood before you start writing the scene, and then you can try and work them in different places to support the mood. Now, within that also there is word choice, and that, you know, my priming example explains that fairly well. I actually had a writing teacher pull up this example, and he said, you can talk about the same behavior using different words, and all of them will carry different emotional contexts. And these are the examples, he said. He said, if you're talking about a girl, you could say she's exploring her sexuality. You could say she's sexually curious. You could say she's promiscuous, or you could say she's a slut. And all of those phrasings and words carry different emotional contexts behind them. And at the same time, they can all be describing the exact same behavior. Now, there is definitely a point of view character element that you'll want to look at as you do this, but these are all elements where you can be talking about the walls or the table or the carpet. You know, all of these things, as you build a setting, you can look at them as to how to strengthen the overall scene and the story and the conflict and the emotions that you want to pull from the reader, all while talking about the wallpaper. And in building the scene out more, the reader feels grounded. One of the things people like about reading is they get to go places they've never been. And if you're not building your setting out enough, then they don't feel like they get to go there. And so that's definitely an important part of setting, is building it out to the point that the reader feels like they are there. Another thing I want to point out is to avoid this scene jumping, because a lot of times you'll be like, well, you know, we're at the house and we have this conflict. Then we want to go to the store and we'll have this discussion with the person here. And then we go to the park, right? And so you're moving from one location to the next. And ideally what you want to do when you're picking a setting is you want to pick a setting where you can have the most number of dramatic events happen in one setting. So you can build it deeper. And you don't have to deal with transitions, right? So that it's without having to slow the pacing too much by describing each and every setting as you move from one place to the next, you can take the opportunity to build one setting very deep and then just have a lot of events happen there as characters move through there. I've been reading How We Found You by J.T. Lawrence, and she, with each setting she goes into, she takes the opportunity to kind of do a little bit of world building. So it is a futurist border sci-fi a novel of kidnapping. And in each new scene, we see a different piece of technology. And so not only is it building the scene with this interesting idea she has of what the future will bring, but it builds out the world deeper. You know, we see how their internet technology is working, and we begin to see how their robotics are working. And just each time we go to a new setting, she puts in a different piece of technology to just build out this world bit by bit without taking, you know, four pages to just drown you in this stuff. And I think it's been very well done. And so building your settings is also a great chance to kind of build out your world as you do it kind of bit by bit. A long time ago, we talked to Mike Glassford, and he talked about this paint by numbers. He says, you know, you can see the whole thing, but you can write a deep setting by picking one element or two and just going very deep on them. So you have the strong setting in that sense, but it's not redundant even if you're in the same place. Some great examples are his book took place on a ship, right? And so the setting is almost the same every time. We're on a ship on the ocean because it's a pirate novel. Similarly, in The Expanse series, almost every setting is on a spaceship, and the same spaceship. Occasionally it jumps to others, but for the most part, there is an inordinate a number of scenes that all take place on the same spaceship. And the author addresses this one with the whole paint by numbers thing, building out bits and pieces of his world by looking at different elements that we haven't seen before with each setting, but also by attaching various emotional connotations to various elements. So Holden's footlocker moves around based on his relationship with Naomi. And so sometimes there's, you know, that's the setting you get, is where is Holden's footlocker at the moment? It's not in this room or it's in that room. You know, it's building that setting, but it's also telling you a lot about how their relationship is going, as very much a subtext to what's happening. One of the things you want to look at, as you're picking your setting, is you want to make it as interesting as possible, right? And when we covered this in Climax, you also want to be within reason, right? So, like, Mars could be an incredibly interesting setting, but you're not going to take a New York crime mystery novel and be like, well, let's put it on Mars because that's a really interesting setting. But, like, that doesn't fit within the schema of the book. Saying that, I feel like that's just, everybody knows that, right? So within the realm of possibility, you do want to try and pick the most interesting scenes, settings possible. And sometimes that's not an option in fitting in with the novel, right? You can't take them somewhere really cool and awesome just because of, you know, the limitations on transportation or whatever. You know, sometimes a scene takes place in a kitchen or a bedroom. And within those elements, what you can do is you can have maybe an object in the setting that is very interesting and intriguing. We talked about building out the sci-fi books, can't remember which one of Stephen King's book this is, but there's one that it takes place in a hospital, and not even the main characters, it's just a set of side characters in the hospital. A boy comes in and his mom is complaining that his feces is pink, like strawberry ice cream pink, and she's really worried about him. And this was something that happened in the 1970s when they developed a new food dye. And it was in this really popular breakfast cereal for kids. And so anyone who's familiar with the scare immediately knows the time period of the book, which can, you know, expand. Suddenly you have an understanding of what technologies are available and different things like that. In movies, one of the things they like to do to kind of do this, to set the time period, is they pick a song that was really popular on the radio. So you'll see the car and you hear the song and it kind of immediately says, you know, this is the 1960s, the 1950s. Or sometimes they run a very popular piece of news reel, right, to immediately kind of set you in the date and the time of the book. And so Stephen King's choice there, it's not as effective at setting the date unless you're familiar with the event, but it also is very interesting. This background event, that's just part of the setting of doctors and nurses and parents going on in a hospital. So in an earlier draft of my own book, trying to use this method of songs to set the time period, my book takes place in the late 1980s. And so I picked a U2 song from the Joshua Tree, or maybe it was a hit single at the time. And it's still a very popular song now. I can't remember which one I picked exactly, but I remember my writing group thinking, was that song even out then? I was like, yeah, that's when it was released. That year, it was like top 40, you know? And they're like, no, they're like, the song is too popular still today, and not enough people associate it with the 80s for it to be effective. And so I had to go back and really sift through the charts and find an artist who was big in the 80s, but career died out in the early 90s. As a much more effective way to use that song to establish time period within the novel. And I think eventually that scene has been pulled completely, so it's no longer relevant. But it was something that I encountered in a piece that is continually popular, not being able to really set the time period for the piece. This next element I want to talk about is what's called essence theory. And I think we've mentioned it before. So we're going to talk about here with setting. Now, understand that essence theory is a style choice. Not everybody subscribes to this. Your big fantasy writers like a George R. R. Martin or somebody, definitely not subscribing to essence theory. So I'm going to talk about it here. And essence theory is essentially converting a setting down to a character. And a character, if you see them, they don't really look like a real person. They've got giant heads, and then the most prominent feature of the person has been exaggerated as well, whether it's their nose or like Jay Leno's chin. And yet, at the same time, you can recognize that person. And that's kind of the idea behind essence theory, is instead of taking paragraph after paragraph to fill out a scene, you use kind of this landscape and centerpiece. The landscape is just blanketly telling the person. It's a bar, it's a restaurant, or whatever. You just kind of get that out there. And then you focus on the one thing that you think really just is the essence, the heart and soul of the setting. And I think I've told this story before, but I'll bring it up again here because I think it's just such a perfect example. And my friend had been told about this restaurant that served really good pizza, and he said, we should go check it out. And the restaurant is like attached to a gas station, right? Like there's a wall that divides the two, and separate entrances for the one for the restaurant and the other for the gas station. But as we walk into the restaurant, there is a sign taped to the cash register, written, not printed, but handwritten, that says, for restroom, ask for key at gas station next door. And I laughed when I saw it because I just felt like it just really encapsulated the entirety of the experience there. I didn't, you know, I don't have to tell you what the restaurant looked like because I had that sign. And, you know, that's what I tell people about. And you get to fill in the rest of the details on your own based on the sign. But I do, but, you know, I mention it's a restaurant. And they had that sign on the cash register. And that's kind of what Essence Theory is about. Picking that one element that really communicates what it's all about. And being thorough in your description of it. It is the exaggerated feature of the character. You describe it very well and in great detail. And then you put it with the landscape. And that's how you've described the scene. Is that one piece of essence. So for myself, usually what I like to do is when I'm making a setting, I go through kind of a template that I have of things I want to think about as I'm writing. Like what is an interesting place, a fitting place, what's something interesting in the place, what's an interesting background event, you know, and I kind of fill out all these things and until I start to have kind of a picture in my mind. And then I put my characters in it, but I don't describe it from a character point of view. I go in as the author, and I describe out everything. And I take, you know, a page or two or three, and I just fill out all of the setting. And then I sift through that for what I think is the essence, the piece that really communicates what this scene is about, both in its location, but also, once again, bringing it back, the mood and the emotion that I want to be driving home within the dramatic scene that will take place here. As we talked about in Climax, a fitting setting can sometimes be something mundane, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the very interesting thing. I'm going to go back to the example we had there because I think it's great. So a playground at a park can be a little bit of a dull setting, but if we have that as the setting for the final conflict between a cop and a child killer, suddenly the child's playground takes on a much more interesting connotation because it's just so fitting for what's about to happen, right? Now, that's not something you can always play with. As we talked about before, like, the climax of Star Wars has to take place on the Death Star, right? Even if you had more interesting place or a more fitting place somewhere else, that's where it has to take place based on the nature of the plot. And there will be times where you have to have a scene take place somewhere, or putting it in something really interesting or fitting would feel a little bit too out of place. And so as we mentioned above, there's a lot of things you can do to enliven a duller scene, whether it be your word choice or your metaphors or just putting something interesting in there, whether it be a background event like Stephen King or an object that's very interesting. Landscape and centerpiece, we've talked about, you know, that broad stroke, where it is. And landscape and centerpiece is also a style choice. Sometimes when I use this technique, I get people saying, well, I feel like you're telling me twice. Like, you told me this was a bar, and then you go in and you describe all the things that make it a bar. But for me, in my own reading, that first landscape stroke, that piece, that broad generalization, helps me picture clearer the smaller pieces. And I've read works where people don't start with a landscape. They just start describing things in it. And it's easy to misinterpret it. I remember I had a friend who was describing a strip club. But I go to a gym where they have poles for their pole class. And I was like, well, when I read this, I thought you were describing a gym. And she was like, why? There's a stripper pole. I was like, yeah. And gyms have a lot of stripper poles, too, because they have that exercise class. And I think it took her aback a little bit. She was a little bit surprised. But again, that's my own life context shifting that, which is part of the reason I like landscape and centerpiece as opposed to just starting in with the details. So like I said, that is again a style choice. There are readers and authors who don't like it, and there are readers and authors who do. You just kind of have to find your own voice and style there. So I'm gonna go ahead and cut it here, and we'll continue on this. I actually still have a ton of research and a ton of notes to cover, but I'm gonna split this in two, mostly because I feel like my voice is giving out. So as when the newsletter comes out at the end of the month, we will put in the exercises and questions and the template for this and the discussion piece that I will cover with Jay later this month. I don't know when you'll get the second half of this discussion. That might not happen until July. Depends. If people keep giving me difficult time in scheduling interviews, you might get it next week, or you know, we'll see. But I won't hold on to it for too long, just because I don't want them to be separated by too much. As always, if you enjoy the show, we would love it if you would leave us a review and share on Facebook or Twitter and iTunes or anything. I probably should set up a Facebook page for the podcast. I haven't done that yet. And if you want to support the show, check out one of our books, High Fantasy, Song of Locke. Jay wrote that. It's kind of an homage to Link from Zelda. He had played the game as a kid and was just fascinated with it. And so he's written this whole story. It's not about Link. He has his own world, but it's very much this boy like Link. He's very adventurous, and he does have this little companion with him that is kind of a trickster character, gives him a hard time and hassles him to keep these interesting. And interesting thing enough, his companion is named Pick, and he is the narrator, and you know almost immediately Pick is an unreliable narrator. Like, he likes to shuffle things to make himself look good and to make things a little bit more dramatic. So it kind of paints it with an interesting light, having that unreliable narrator there. So if you're a fan of High Fantasy, or you like an unreliable narrator, check it out. Also, you can check out my book, When the Sky Falls. It is an espionage historical conspiracy thriller, despite the fact that most people think it looks like a post-apocalyptic. But we're changing that, and hopefully soon we'll get a new cover there. And as always, thanks for listening.